Okay, well, thank you everyone for coming to Persian Circle today, even though the weather is so great outside. Our speaker is Professor Stolper from the OI, Professor of Assyriology and Oriental Studies at the Oriental Institute. And today he'll be talking about the Persepolis Fortification Archive, which is going to be quite interesting and a treat for all of us. So.
We'll see.
Please.
Well, thank you. And thank you for inviting me, and thank you for permitting to speak to you in English. Many years ago, I could speak a lot of Persian in a pretty comical fashion, but as I keep telling people, the only verb I can remember now is feromush kardan, so I won't attempt to put together a sentence. I realize it's rude of me, but of course it's courteous of you in ways that I have come to expect. And thank you for letting me come here. I thought it would be a salutary demonstration that people from the Oriental Institute sometimes cross the street even when there is no food and drink involved. And I have to warn you that I get kind of wound up about this topic. So if you feel you've had enough and you want to leave in the middle of it, go ahead. I won't be the least bit offended, and I might not even notice. So anyhow, let me go ahead. What I'm showing you here is a couple of tablets from the Persepolis Fortification Archive, and the reason I'm showing you these is they illustrate three of the different streams of information that come together in the archive. There's the end of a cuneiform text in the Elamite language here. There's a very nice rolling of a seal impression, and as you can see, there's a little one word in Aramaic written in ink on the surface of the tablet. And here you can see a little bit of Aramaic in ink also. These are images that are made by a technology called polynomial texture mapping, PTM. Is a kind of reflectance transformation imaging, RTI, and if there's one thing I've learned from the world of technology, it's the importance of TLAs, three-letter abbreviations, so you have to throw them around, and this is what it does. It allows the viewer to control the apparent angle, intensity, focus of the light on here, so that what we're doing is making images that allow cuneiformists who want to look at this part, art historians who want to look at this part, and Semitic epigraphers who want to look at this part, to look at these tablets literally, each by his own lights. That's one of the things that we're doing over there. The reason we're doing this is because we're trying to make a record of these that will be useful for continuing research, even if access to the tablets themselves is lost. So let me switch screens here. So why am I concerned about whether access to the tablets will be lost? Well, because it's a very real concern. There are lawsuits now before federal courts in Chicago that are seeking to seize the tablets, seeking to force the sale of the tablets. And win or lose, whether the plaintiffs win or whether they lose, it is very likely that the access to the tablets will be lost, perhaps catastrophically, and almost certainly in a way that attenuates what we can still learn from the archive. So that's what I want to be talking about. First of all, what the Persepolis Fortification Archive is, why it matters, or at least why I think it matters, a little bit about what the problem is, and a little bit about some of the kind of cultural context of the issue. So here's the Persian Empire, or at least some of it. It actually went off in that direction a ways and off in that direction a ways. Founded, as you know, by Cyrus II, called the Great, in the years after 550 BC, and by 500 BC, it spanned a continent. It reached from India and Central Asia to Egypt and Macedonia, and it incorporated almost every literate complex society of the ancient world. There were, of course, some holdouts, famously mainland Greece. But even for the holdouts, their encounter with the Persian Empire had, as you know, a profound effect on the shape of their cultural identity and therefore on what we all have come to call Western civilization. After all, the oldest Greek tragedy that has come down to us is the Persians of Aeschylus, and the so-called father of history is Herodotus, whose topic was the encounter between Greece and the Persians. Persepolis, as I'm sure most of you know, is a complex of palaces in the very heartland of the Persian Empire, in Fars, in Persia proper, about 25 miles from modern Shiraz. It was founded soon after 520 BC by Darius II, also called the Great. It was destroyed in 330 BC by Alexander III, also called the Great. Here's a little lesson for you. And it was excavated by people from the University of Chicago who mostly weren't called great, at least not by each other, between 1931 and 1939. And here's how the excavations looked from the air during that time. This is around 1935. And in 1933, the diggers discovered clay tablets and fragments. And that's where they found them, in two rooms of a gatehouse in the fortification wall that surrounds the Tacht and also goes up around the crown of the Khur Rahmat behind it. So this was a little fortification wall, and that's why they're called fortification tablets, not because they have anything to do with fortifications, but because they came from these rooms in the fortification. 1933, it was the depth of the Great Depression. In fact, on March 4th, 1933, the very day that Franklin Roosevelt here was being inaugurated as President of the University of the United States for the first time, and a couple of days before he shut down every bank in the country to avoid a worldwide financial collapse, which is why we don't inaugurate presidents in March anymore. Sure learned the lesson, didn't we? Right? That could never happen again. On that very day, the director of the excavation, Ernst Herzfeld, sent a telegram to the director of the Oriental Institute, James Henry Breasted, saying, "Hundreds, probably thousands, business tablets, Elamite discovered on terrace." That's the kind of prose that in the days before Twitter used to be called telegraphic. I don't know, is there 140 characters in there? In fact, by the end of the summer, the diggers had found not hundreds and not thousands, but tens of thousands of pieces, and they weren't just in Elamite. So what do they find, and why does it matter? Well, to begin with, there are four main kinds of documents. There are pieces like this, pieces that have text in cuneiform script in the Elamite language, almost all of them with impressions of seals, sometimes one seal, sometimes more than one seal. And there are a lot of these. The tablets and fragments, we estimate, are the remains of somewhere between 10 and 15,000 original documents. But there are also things like this, tablets, clay tablets with pieces in Aramaic, Aramaic script, Aramaic language. All of these have seal impressions. There are not so many of these. We've got a little bit over 700 now, and I doubt if we'll get as many as 800 in the end. But there are also pieces like this. Tablets that have no text on them at all, but have the impressions of stamp seals or cylinders, seals, and sometimes more than one seal, sometimes the same seals, mostly not the same seals that you find on the other kinds of tablets. And then there's the fourth category, none of above, these odd, unique things. One tablet written in Greek, or at least in Greek script, one in probably in Phrygian, and this one actually written in Old Persian script and Old Persian language, tablets in which instead of seals they used coins, and in case you don't recognize it, that's an Athenian tetradram. So we actually have evidence of Greek numismatics coming from Persepolis in a dated context better than anything you have in Greece. And then on top of that, there's this, sort of thousands and thousands of flakes and fragments and crumbs, and some of them are pieces you can put together to form a useful text, and others are pieces that will probably never be useful, even if they fall into the hands of the students who occupied the American Embassy back in 1979 and started putting back together the contents of the wastebaskets from the shredders. I mean, when I was there in 2004, they were up to 15 volumes of reconstructed, shredded documents, and they might be able to do something with this, but some of them will elude even them. Let me back up. Well, there are tens of thousands of pieces, and I have to say, the three most frequently asked questions are, first, how many of these are there? Second, how much money are they worth? And then a very, very, very distant third is, what are they about and what are they good for? So the answer to how many are there is actually pretty complicated, because there are tens of thousands of pieces, but they're actually all pieces of one thing. They're records that come from one administrative organization that handled the storage and payment of food for people on government payrolls in a very short time, around 20 years in the region around Persepolis. But they're pieces that fit together in a systematic way. They're a system through which information once flowed, and it's structured in a way that tells us about the environment in which this administrative system and this information system operated, in exactly the same way that thousands of fossil bones of some defunct creature, bones of different sizes, different shapes, different types, different functions, fit together once you put them together in a meaningful way as one thing that once had more to it, the one thing through which blood and food once flowed and shaped in a way that tells you something about its environment. So the answer to how many are there is there's one. It could be that, you know, when you're in the field museum standing in front of this, you say, gee, I wonder how many bones they found. But it's probably not your first question. And you probably don't say, gee, I wonder how they know that big piece went on this end and that little piece went on that end, because once you put it together, it sort of makes sense. Well, we're still in the putting together part, but the basic concept is there's one of them. But as I told you, what they're about is food, beer and wine, grain and fruit, sheep and goats, nameless workers drawing rations and their nameless bosses, pieces of dirt about people who have turned to dirt thousands of years ago. And what they're not about is the deeds and characters of ancient kings, or armies on the march, or harem hijinks. In other words, they're not about all those things that people have been looking for in the Achaemenid Persian Empire, from Hellenistic novels through European and American art and through sword and sandal movies made now. So if they're not giving people this sort of thing that they like, why should they be important? Well, here's why I think they're important. When you actually do start to fit these crummy little pieces of dirt together, they become the largest, the densest, the most complex, the best dated, and the best contextualized source of information from inside Persia on the languages, the art, the society, the religion, the institutions, and the history of the Persian Empire at its zenith in the middle of the reign of Darius, when it stretched from India to the borders of Greece. And it's important because this is a unique source. There's nothing else like it, nothing that's been found, and there's no other source that provides the information that these provide in anything like this volume. So let me elaborate on that a little bit. First of all, I said languages. Most of the texts are in Elamite, as I told you. And Elamite, in case you don't know it, is a linguistic isolate. It was the indigenous language written and spoken in a large part of Western Iran for years, thousands, at least 1,000 years before the first speakers of Iranian languages arrived. And some of the texts are in Aramaic, as you know, a Semitic language that was a kind of lingua franca for interregional communication already under the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian Empire, and spread over a much wider area by the Achaemenid Empire. They were using it for local recording and for interregional communication, for communication between areas that had different first languages, all the way from Central Asia to Southern Egypt, in a fairly consistent dialect that nowadays is called, what else? Imperial Aramaic. But these Elamite texts and these Aramaic texts were written by and for speakers of Persian, and not just Persian, but other old Iranian dialects spoken around Persia and in other parts of Iran. And the result is that when you're writing in Elamite and writing in Aramaic, it's full of transcriptions of names, of administrative terms, and even calques on old Iranian syntax, morphological and syntactic patterns. So what you actually have here is not only very large and significant corpora, bodies of linguistic information for the study of three different languages, three actually linguistically unrelated languages, languages that don't even come from the same family, but you also have one large corpus that gives you an extraordinary amount of information about language interference, literacy, the practice of literacy in several different languages at the heart of the court of what, after all, was a multilingual empire that described itself as multi-ethnic and multilingual. I'm stressing this because, you know, here I am talking to a bunch of people in Persian studies, and I teach a bunch of people who study Assyriology, and other people study, you know, Aramaic and so on. Once you get to a university, all those things are carved up into different areas, but the fact is, nowhere in the ancient Near East, any more in the modern Near East, was anybody monolingual, and were any of these things not interacting? And if you can do this right, you can see, even in a modern university, you can begin to see this in a sort of more realistic portrayal of what literacy and language and ethnic identity mean. I mentioned art. Most of the tablets have impressions of cylinder seals or stamp seals, sometimes two seals, sometimes three, sometimes four or five. This is often described as a kind of minor art form by comparison to, say, monumental art like the reliefs on the walls of palaces. But of course, this minor art form shows you a range of images, a range of style, a range of competence of craftsmanship, adaptation and experiment, the hand and eye not only of the person making the seal, but of the client who's buying the seal, a much larger range of this stuff than you can ever find in monumental art. Why? Because monumental art has one client, the king, you know, and by the time it goes up on the wall of the palace, you're pretty much done with it. And it's going to do one kind of thing. But when you see these things, you see a range of things you'll never find. I mean, nobody's going to show you a palace wall that has a couple of satyrs dancing around a chicken like that. And whatever's going on here might be in part of the palace, but I doubt it. Right? That's not going to be in monumental form. We don't get to see that if it's up to the kings. And what's more, there are thousands of these images. So far, we've identified a little bit less than 3,000 distinct seals from their impressions on these tablets. And that means 3,000 seals means 3,000 distinct individuals or offices that are actually using these seals. And that's the thing that you have to remember. We're not seeing the seals, we're seeing the impressions. We're seeing these things being used. We're not seeing things that are in the collections of people scattered around, removed from their context. We're seeing it embedded in an administrative context, in a social context, and we're seeing in the same way that texts are representatives of actual utterances, actual behavior. You're seeing here the representatives of 3,000 people in their activity and representing what are actually, you know, some forms of aesthetic and social choices for this. This isn't a corpus that you find in a museum or in a collector's vitrine, right, that comes from museums and collectors and, you know, eventually from thieves is where that stuff comes from. This was excavated, so we've actually got the connections among the bits representing an ancient reality. It all comes from a particular time, place, and circumstance. It's not a modern accident. And these are pictures that are connected with the text, so they're intimately embedded in a historical context and in a social context. We have, you know, a visual representation of 3,000 or more individuals. This is going to be one of the largest bodies of ancient imagery from anywhere in the ancient world. And when we sort of talk about this to classical archaeologists, the comparison is this thing called the Beazley Catalog of Greek red figure vases. Is the biggest single catalog of Greek red figure vases, and they're scattered all over museums and collections. There's 3,500 of them. We're going to have 3,500 of these. They're not red figure vases. They're a lot less grand, but they're fitted together in a way that stuff never can. It's an astonishing corpus for people who, you know, think about art as more than just art. Because, among other things, it is a representation of society. I said these things are about food, and most of these things deal with food being handed out to people. But the consumers of this stuff, the people who get the food, range from gangs of nameless workers who are living or getting less than subsistence rations, through their supervisors who get a little bit more, through the district superintendents who get somewhat more, and the clerks and the auditors and the people who wrote these texts and manage these systems, but up through members of the royal family, and in fact, in some cases, gods, that is, religious observations, get these, and you can actually go a little bit to the subhuman level, because animals sometimes get them. So what you're seeing here, this magnificent stamp seal with a couple of mastiffs attaching a stag, we know from this text who this belongs to. It belongs to a guy who in Greek would be called Gobrias. He is the father of a guy who in Greek would be called Mardonius. He, Gobrias, is the son-in-law of Darius. He is drawing travel rations here, and oddly enough, there's another text that gives travel rations for what appears to be his wife. They're both going to the same place. His son, this guy called Mardonius, was commander of the Persian army that invaded Greece in 480 BC. So you're not seeing anything that Aeschylus tells you. You're not seeing their characters and motives. You're looking at them through their lunch boxes. But you're looking at them, not only them, but you're looking at everybody all the way down to workers in the field. You're seeing a transect through a society of a kind that you cannot possibly find in literary sources. You can't find them in scriptures, and you can't find it in historical sources. The duller and the most everyday the text, the more of them you get, the more of the society you can find. And these guys, these ordinary workers, they're sometimes described in terms of their ethnic origin, sometimes in terms of their craftsmanship, sometimes in terms of social status, in a couple of terms, sometimes in terms of simply who's in charge of them. So you can kind of create a sort of social texture out of this, of a sort that's also unparalleled in any other sources. You just have to get used to thinking of social texture in terms somewhat different from, you know, the way history books describe it. Okay, I'm sorry, I told you I get a little wound up about it. I told you religion. Well, they're not really about religion, but you have two kinds of sources. I told you, for one thing, one of the things that's done with the food that's handed out is it's handed out to, for example, priests, and it's sometimes handed out for use for religious observances for a whole range of gods. Ahura Mazda is mentioned, but so are a bunch of other gods, both Iranian and non-Iranian by name, and some of them show you things like this. That is, the actual visualization of religious practice, the kind of thing you don't find described in these texts, and you probably don't find it described in any other texts either. And, of course, they also do what all art does. That is, they give you a sort of visualization of the invisible conceptual world that surrounds the people who are using it. You know, when we go to a museum and we see pictures of angels or saints and so on, we get so used to the iconography of this that it doesn't require much explanation. But if you go into an Athenaeum somewhere and you see a picture of George Washington wearing a Roman toga, you know, try to explain that to a visitor from Mars. George Washington was a Roman? Well, no. Why did, you know, was it Halloween? Well, no. But, you know, we know what it means, right? In that case, it's not even a conceptual world. It's reading somebody else's history onto our history in a way that we don't even think twice about. Well, that's, you know, what you're supposed to do with this kind of thing. One of the things you're supposed to do. And as I told you, this is a unique source. It's unique in two senses. Since these tablets were discovered, we've got a few others like them, a few isolates, and that's enough to confirm what we would have surmised anyway, namely that there once were other archives of this kind, but we haven't found them. They may still be out there to be found, but they haven't been found. So far, this is the only one we have. There are plenty of tyrannosaurs out there. I think something like 300 was the last count I had of substantial tyrannosaurs. There's only one Persepolis fortification archive. And, as I said, it's unique in the other sense. That is, this kind of information and this combination of information and this density of information doesn't exist anywhere else. So, of course, each one of these tablets carries a pretty complex information load with its own value. And for tablet nerds like me, you know, every one of these is a little delight. I could, you know, happily hold forth on this one and, you know, maybe one other person on the planet would be interested, except he's not speaking to me anymore. So. But when you start putting the pieces together, it's like any other science, right? The importance isn't in the data, it's in the connections, sort of the sort of invisible tension structure that gets more stable as you tie in more pieces. So the point I always have to make about it is this archive is rich, it's dense, it's complex, and it's at least potentially coherent. And the current litigation throws the future of these many Persepolis tablets into uncertainty. But it also, what's more important, is it threatens to destroy the integrity of the one single Persepolis fortification archive by breaking it up in some way that will fatally damage what its biggest value comes from. The fact that it hasn't already been broken up is actually something sort of extraordinary. And to explain that, I have to go back to the 1930s and before. So return with me now to the thrilling days of yesteryear. You probably recognize the sculpture over the entry to the Oriental Institute, founded in 1919. Quite a year, 1919, when the peace conference is after World War I, the war to make the world safe for democracy. We're busy creating a completely impossible political order in Europe and reorganizing a lot of Ottoman territories in a way to make those parts of the world safe for empire. The Oriental Institute was actually founded with an extraordinary vision, a very broad vision of research on the unique origins of human civilization and its early history in the Near East. The way Breasted said is, we now know, thanks to paleontology and so on, how people got to be human, and we know a lot of the history of civilization, and the important thing is what comes in between, people being human and people being civilized. The fact is, if you read the way he articulated it, it's really pretty cringeworthy and very, you know, neo-colonial and very evolutionist. But the basic idea is pretty stirring still, I think. The articulation is naive or chauvinistic, but comes out as sort of brilliant if you boil it down to the underlying idea. And the Oriental Institute actually carried out this vision under really opportune political and economic circumstances after the First World War, when the British and the French were trying to reestablish themselves in the Near East, but they were broke, and they had this history of imperial control. And although certainly the Americans, and Breasted in particular, was sympathetic to, you know, British mandate form of post-colonialism, or pre-post-colonialism, whatever you want to call it, the Americans had some advantage because they didn't actually have an empire. And they also had some money. So he sets up all of these expeditions from Egypt to Persia. You will recall that in Persia, Reza Khan took power in 1921. There he is in the background looking not very promising behind the last Shah of the last Qajar Shah. And he made himself Reza Shah Pahlavi in 1925, and of course instituted a regime that was secularizing, modernizing, westernizing, like many regimes of the time, and of course as a usurper, very nationalistic and very authoritarian. And in 1927, actually in connection with that, the French monopoly on archaeology and antiquities in Iran was ended, because Reza Shah, to a greater degree than any of the Qajars, saw the antiquity of Iran as part of a sort of nationalist project. And a brand new antiquities law governing archaeology as well took effect in Iran in 1931. This man, Ernst Herzfeld, helped to write it. He was a German. For more than 20 years, he had been hoping to direct archaeological work at Persepolis, which, strangely enough, had been almost untouched by many explorers for centuries before that. There he is posing with his cigar, looking like an English gentleman, and in a leisurely moment feeding his pet boar, Bulbul, at the excavation. But he was German. He would love to have had a German expedition, but it's 1931, and Germany is crippled economically. America isn't in such great shape in 1931 either, but he got sponsorship from the Oriental Institute, and the Oriental Institute found a donor to sponsor the work, and then Herzfeld immediately obtained a permit to excavate Persepolis and nearby sites. It was really the first permit issued under the new excavation law, and, you know, characteristic Chicago fashion, make no small plans. They went for the biggest, the most important, the most ideologically charged site in the country and said, oh, we'll take that. Well, it started out in the Depression, and the Depression got deeper, and so even American funding was pretty scanty, and there were some pretty hairy times in the course of the excavation, but the results were just spectacular, and they really got international attention. So when you read those Agatha Christie novels about archaeology, that's the kind of thing that they were doing. And there were a lot of sort of, Persepolis became a hip destination for, you know, 30s motor travelers and, you know, Weimar travelers, saying, let's pop in the car now that we can do it and motor off to Persepolis and see what's up. This was all over the papers in New York and in London and so on. And he found, among other things, these spectacular reliefs on the palaces that just blew people away, you know, perfectly preserved because it had been completely buried. So not only were Westerners impressed, but let's see. Oh, damn, it's the wrong picture here. Sorry, I got these in the wrong order. But so was Reza Shah, who visited the site in 1932. And according to Breasted, quote, he expressed himself as exceedingly gratified with what he saw. You, he said to Hertzfeld, are doing the work of civilization. And 4 months later was when they found the tablets, and Breasted and Hertzfeld sent that cable to Breasted. Now, as the cable implied, the discovery was a kind of surprise. They were building a ramp to get up into the terrace to bring water up and take dirt off and take fines off so that they could be packed up. And so they were building this road. It was really the only logical place to do it. And to their immense surprise, they started to find thousands of tablets. It was an unparalleled find. As I said, only one other tablet of this kind had ever been found before. And of course, it was an Achaemenid Elamite administrative text. And that's what you could say. It was Achaemenid, it was Elamite, it was administrative. You know, what else can you do with it? You can't connect one dot. It's science, right? So now we had tens of thousands of dots. And that made it overwhelming, because by the autumn of 33, Hertzfeld estimated that there were something like 30,000 or more tablets and fragments and innumerable flakes and crumbs. Now, the Antiquities Law of 1931 was like the law that had been introduced a few years before in Iraq, in that it allowed for a division of fines between the host country and the sponsoring institutions. And most antiquities laws in the Middle East and many other places were like this sort of until the 70s. The law in Iran didn't change, I think, until 74. It's what museums nowadays like to call partage, because it sounds better in French. And in fact, later groups of tablets were divided under this. People treated groups of tablets not as groups, but as a bunch of tablets. So, you know, 50 for me, 50 for you. And so we have some in the Oriental Institute that were later excavated to Persepolis that became property of the Oriental Institute, and the other half stayed in Tehran. But not this very first group. Quite extraordinarily, the very first group of tablets was treated as one thing, and the entire thing was loaned to Chicago in 1936 for conservation, for study, for recording, and for eventual publication, and for eventual return. That sounds great, I mean, but that statement glosses over rather delicate and sometimes very bitter negotiations among a lot of odd people, representatives of the Iranian regime who were gradually becoming disenchanted with Americans and Europeans, representative of the Oriental Institute, State Department, U.S. State Department people who are negotiating for it, and Hertzfeld's deputies, his successor, and his many, many professional and political enemies, both in Iran or Germany. Hertzfeld seems to have been sort of extraordinary. He was a man of immense knowledge and immense erudition, and he had the ability to make people detest him, you know, almost instantly. He's sort of the converse of Will Rogers, who said, "I never met a man I didn't like." I mean, Hertzfeld never met anybody he was incapable of making dislike him. And the place was, geez, I mean, so here he is. Here's his crew, right? That's Hertzfeld, you know, in his English milord salt and pepper tweed. His architect, Krefter, looking as he's just about to go off to some Weimar cabaret. And that's a man named Alexander Langsdorff, dressed in his Tintin outfit here. Langsdorff paused on the way out of Iran in 1933 long enough to write a denunciation of Hertzfeld, and he went back to Germany, joined the Nazi Party and the SS. So here he is in his SS uniform, lecturing to the Leibstandarte, the first SS regiment. This is Arthur Upham Pope, who was Hertzfeld's great rival in Iran, and he wanted to be the great doyen of Iranian art and antiquity. This is Andre Godard, who was the director of the brand new museum in Tehran, who was very unhappy that the French monopoly had been ended. It was like a bag of scorpions in Iran, but, you know, in spite of this absolutely poisonous atmosphere, what did we end up with? This absolutely extraordinary act of trust, you know, a major, completely unique discovery from the foremost, most ideologically charged archaeological site in Iran, loaned to an American research institution for conservation and study, and loaned as a single thing, not in pieces, not divided up into a lot of bits. Quite amazing, you know. I don't know if there are any precedents for that in the earlier archaeology of the Middle East. Most of what happened is people took stuff back, or they didn't take stuff back, and that was that. Something like this, this sort of delicate but nevertheless extraordinary act of trust. But I mean, you will recognize that this is now, this is the model for a kind of relationship that's now absolutely fundamental to any kind of research or exhibition of cultural heritage materials. This is the kind of thing that museums depend on now. So when it's threatened, as it now is by this lawsuit, it's a problem. I'll come back to that. The research in Chicago, let me skip on, went pretty slowly because of what I've just mentioned. There were no comparable materials. Everything had to start from absolute scratch. And then on top of that, the team that started to work on it got broken up when World War II started and interrupted a lot of academic careers. And in the end, most of the work came down to one man, and this is him, Richard Hallock, who in 1969 published this extraordinary edition of 2,000 of the Elamite texts, only 2 years before he retired, just in time to get him promoted before he retired. People didn't think much of him in the department and at the Oriental Institute, but the book is extraordinary, and as people began to use it, it actually transformed every aspect of the serious study of the languages and history of the Achaemenid Persian Empire. The first people who really got how important it was were not our colleagues here, were not Assyriologists. They were people who did classical history and Greek epigraphy and Iranian languages, and then gradually it sank in with other people that this was completely changing the way you looked at the whole period. You still can write the kinds of history of the Persian Empire that you used to find in classical history texts. They're always subtitled, you know, The Defense of the West, right? When the valiant Greeks save Western civilization from the barbarian hordes. You can do that still, and people still do it, believe it or not, but in order to do it, you really have to ignore an enormous amount of really vibrant research that's been going on since, mostly since the late 70s and especially since the 80s. You know, we're professors. We can ignore whatever we want to. So anyhow, these things were supposed to go back, and the return of the material, of course, also went slowly, but we sent about 30,000 little fragments that didn't seem to be useful for study back already in 1948, and about 175 in the early 50s, and then another 300 after we'd done new digital photography and collations. We sent those back in 2004, and we got a lot of good publicity. You know, it was this kind of classic situation saying, despite political tensions between America and Iran, you know, the scholars are keeping their promises, and the next thing we know, we got the lawsuit. That's what happens when you get publicity. The plaintiffs in this litigation, they're the families of the victims of bombings in Jerusalem and in Beirut, and they're able to sue under a uniquely American amendment to a sort of international standard of foreign sovereign immunity law. It allows private citizens, American citizens, to sue sovereign entities in connection with terrorist acts on the grounds that sovereign entities, governments, are the sponsors of non-sovereign actors, terrorists. And a suit like that was brought against two of them, against the Islamic Republic of Iran, and Iran didn't answer, so the plaintiffs got default judgments. Default judgments amounting now to more than $3 billion. Right? I feel like Carl Sagan when I'm saying this. It's an extraordinary amount of money. And they are seeking possession of the Persepolis fortification tablets, among other items, as partial satisfaction in these judgments. Most people will say, why go after these? Why not go after, you know, all of the untold riches of the Iranian, well, because nobody can find anything to lay hands on. And this looked like it might be accessible. I have to stress, you know, the plaintiffs hold default judgments, but in the law, a default judgment is as good as a judgment on the merits. So what's at issue now has nothing to do with whether Iran had any responsibility for the bombings at all. That's not legally at issue. What's at issue now is whether the law entitles the plaintiffs to take this kind of thing, to take non-commercial cultural heritage materials. And among the various museums involved in the suit, the Oriental Institute is in this rather unique position because we're not defending stuff that we have. We say this belongs to Iran. It doesn't belong to us. We're supposed to be working on this and giving it back. So I have to say this also, because some of the reporting says that, oh, the University of Chicago is trying to seize the tablets. Well, it's not. We're, you know, in effect on the same side of the suit as Iran is. And then there are other people in universities who say, oh, this is sort of an atrocious act by a bunch of greedy Philistine barbarians trying to destroy cultural heritage. And I have to say, that's not so either. You know, the plaintiffs are men and women whose lives have been utterly shattered by, you know, truly atrocious acts. When you sort of see what's happened to the survivors and what's happened to the families of the people who didn't survive, it's just awful. And I have to say, if any of them actually get any money out of this, it'll be a tiny amount of money. The amount of money that they're likely to get from this is very small. So if they're greedy, they're not realistic. And I certainly think that it doesn't do anybody any good to think of them as mere barbarians. Well, as I said, in 1936, there were very few, if any, precedents for the loan of these tablets. But as I also said, the loan is an early example of a relationship that's essential for modern work on cultural heritage materials, and that's one of the reasons this lawsuit is important. Let me see if I've got another thing here. So here's a couple of articles from a year or two ago. One of them is a review of an exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum. It's called Beyond Babylon, and one of the things that happened there is they were supposed to get 50 items from Syria, and they didn't get them. Why didn't they get them? They couldn't get, in time for the exhibition, they couldn't get State Department immunity from prosecution of this kind. The law is supposed to have the proviso that immunizes things from seizure. And if the Metropolitan Museum can't do it, that means nobody can do it. I mean, hell, the Metropolitan Museum is more important than the government of New York, I'd say, in terms of their money and influence. And here's the other thing that's also in Antiquity magazine, referring more or less to the same thing. So, you know, what's at issue here is not just the fate of these tablets. It's also cultural heritage research of many kinds, the possession and loan of things like this, but fieldwork operations of a lot of things. So this really has kind of broad implications. Well, that's the broad implications are for other people. I have narrow concerns, Persepolis Fortification Archive, and the Persepolis Fortification Archive Project, which is now based at the Oriental Institute, but it involves a team of editors and technical specialists and other collaborators from a bunch of institutions. Thanks to electronic methods and media, you can actually put together a team that's scattered over a large part of the world. And we've got an emergency, so we have two pretty clear, intimately connected priorities. The first is to make future research possible by making usable records of these objects. And the second is to make current research possible by distributing the records that we're making quickly and continuously and at no cost. And to do that, we're using various electronic means. One of the things we do is conservation, of course. One of the things we do is imagery. I showed you one kind of imagery. Here's another kind we're doing. Can you see the Aramaic text under all the crap on the surface there? Maybe just barely able to see some ink. That's a picture of it done in more or less daylight. And I have to tell you, if you held it in light like this in your hand, you'd have to look much more closely to see any text on it. It would look just about black. If you photograph it under polarized light, the text starts to come out. If you photograph it under red filtered light, it comes out pretty well. And under infrared, it's a nice legible text. So one of the things we're doing is actually making records of this that are more useful in certain ways than the original objects themselves are. We're also doing this other stuff that I just showed you, this polynomial texture mapping that allows users to control the apparent lighting of the text in ways that isn't quite as good as being able to jiggle the original around under a light, but it's almost as good as being able to have a tablet glued to a desk and move a light around over it. And of course, that's very good for surface features like cuneiform text, like seal impressions, like, well, in this case, you can see there's an inked text, but you can also see the stroke of the instrument that made it. This is the point where I often ask if anybody remembers fountain pens, right? Because you can see that's made with a split nib pen, right? Not with a brush, not with a stylus. Some of them are and some of them aren't. You can actually sort of follow this, which means also you can see with this you can see parts of the character that aren't preserved in the ink anymore. So this turns out to be useful for all kinds of things. Useful for something like this, where one person wants to be able to light it to look at the text, and another person wants to be able to light it to be able to look at the seal impression underneath it. I'm not going to dwell on this a lot, and we're also trying to distribute this stuff online in various ways, in this case with transliteration, imagery, images tagged so you can actually connect transliteration, the actual signs that are realizing this transliteration, the translation, a click-through glossary that will get you another example of the same usage, and the glossary is parsed so we can also display grammar and search for, I hope, morphology and syntax eventually. And we're actually producing odd results. I mean, not only the kind of thing that I told you was important, that is fitting together thousands and thousands of little pieces, but along the way we make these totally surprising discoveries. I showed you this thing. This tablet is in Old Persian script and in Old Persian language. It is the only such thing anybody has ever found anywhere. People used to say, I've said in print, Old Persian was developed entirely for display purposes. It's only on sumptuary goods. People didn't do it, didn't use it for everyday use. So when I wrote this up, I got to quote myself and refute myself. Right? It's great. So I can now say that at least one Persian in Persia wrote Persian in Persian, and he thought that at least one other Persian, if he couldn't read it, could at least file it. And that comes as an immense surprise. So look here. This is from the website of the Farhangistan, and here's Madame Harib giving a lecture on the evolution of Old Persian writing, and look what she's talking about. So we're out there. And what's more, this is my other poster child for why you use electronic media.